offering my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, I welcome you to this week's episode of the Gita series, A Triune Pilgrimage. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, coming to you live from our studios at Prashanthi Nilayam. This is a series where we go through the most beautiful and profound work of Sanatan Dharma, the Bhagavad Gita. Swami has given us this beautiful opportunity to do this together, where we go through each verse of the Bhagavad Gita, try to understand the meaning of it, and also dwell upon what it is trying to teach us. As Swami would say, the mere reading of the Bhagavad Gita or recitation of the Bhagavad Gita or to know it by heart is not what Gita is meant for. All of Vedanta and all of Bhagavad Gita, the essence of it, is meant to be practiced, and I think that is what is going to be the endeavor in whatever we do, whatever we take up as part of our study. And this time it is the Bhagavad Gita, and we begin with a prayer to Swami that we don't go through these scriptures not just superficially, but with the prayer and with the earnest effort that these should become a part of our understanding and our way of life. This is the fourth episode of the series and the third episode where we are going through the shlokas as such. The last week around we had completed till the 11th shloka, and that's where we stopped, and it was a pretty story-based episode, if I could say that, because the episode where Duryodhana is pointing out to the various warriors on the side of the Kauravas, and I think I took the time out to explain about some of the characters who are mentioned. And the reason why I did that was, you know, Sage Vyasa has decided that these names have to be mentioned as part of the Bhagavad Gita, and I thought it is good for us to look at the background of these great heroes and warriors whose names were mentioned, and I think that's what we had gone through. And we concluded with three verses that show the state of mind of Duryodhana, the primary aggressor, if we could say that, because he is the main cause for this entire war. Had he agreed for the truce, had he first of all not been an adharmic person, the war wouldn't have come by at all. Or even if he had agreed for the truce, which the Pandavas were ready to offer him, this wouldn't have happened. So he is the main person who is instrumental in this Mahabharata war coming across. We came across these three verses where Duryodhana tries to show that he is very, very confident, because the numbers are on his side. He's got a larger army. He's got greater warriors on his side. And comparatively, the Pandava forces are less experienced, and he is trying to exude that confidence. But in spite of all this, the physical numbers being on his side, there is a sense of nervousness which is betraying him. It is coming out even though he is trying to conceal it. And Sage Vyasa brings it about in a couple of verses very beautifully, where he points out to his army and he says, these are all warriors who have come here to die for me. And he almost makes it a proclamation. Instead of saying that they've come here prepared to die for me, he says they've come here to die for me. And it's almost prophetic, because all of them, most of the great warriors, would perish in that war trying to fight for Duryodhana. And then we came across that verse where Sage Vyasa very beautifully uses two words, paryaptam and aparyaptam, which have meanings that are ambiguous. It could mean that Duryodhana is saying that my army is sufficient. It could also mean that Duryodhana is saying that my army is insufficient. So in a verse, where Duryodhana is proclaiming his confidence, Sage Vyasa uses such words which suggest that hidden within that confidence is a certain sense of nervousness. And I think we spoke about how that nervousness is born out of adharma itself. Anybody who is straying away from dharma, anybody who is faultly and anybody who is wrongly trying to usurp what belongs to somebody else, or is trying to be unrighteous, there will be a sense of nervousness and uncertainty and fear which is hidden within that confidence which they try to portray outside. And that was, Duryodhana was a typical example of such behavior. And finally, we concluded with the verse, the 11th verse, where Duryodhana says, that let us all protect Bhishma. You know, till this point, he's saying that we have a greater army, we have the great Bhishma who is protecting us and all of that. But he finally concludes by saying, so let us all protect Bhishma. And of course, we spoke about why he specifically mentions this. So this is where we had stopped last week. So we'll continue with that. This was the 11th verse where we stopped. The next is going to be the 12th and the 13th verse together, because I think that makes more sense. I'll play out the verses 12 and 13 and I'll read out the meaning after that. And then we'll discuss about what is significant about that verse. As you all know, the verses are being chanted or recited by Brother Shyam, one of our alumnus and a volunteer of Radio Sai. So we listen to the verses 12 and 13 in the voice of Brother Shyam.
Tasya sanjanayan harsham kuru vriddhav pitamahah simhanadam vinadyochaihi shankham dadmau pratapavan tata shankhascha bheryascha panavanaka gomukhah sahasaivabhyahanyant sashabdastumulobhavat.
Then Bhishma, the great valiant grandsire of the Kuru dynasty, the grandfather of the fighters, now blew his conch shell very loudly and roared like a lion in order to cheer Duryodhana. Just immediately after that, conches and kettle drums and tabors and trumpets and cow horns blared forth. That sound became tumultuous. So that's the meaning of verses 12 and 13. As I just mentioned in the introduction, Duryodhana is trying to hide his nervousness, saying, oh, we have these great warriors and we have the greatest Bhishma who has the boon of dying only when he chooses to die, so no one is going to be able to defeat him. He is the disciple of the great Parashurama himself, and all of this confidence, but he says that let us protect Bhishma. And hearing this, all this while, we saw that Duryodhana actually speaks to Dronacharya, not to Bhishma, who is his commander-in-chief. He speaks to Dronacharya and then he speaks to the other warriors that let us protect Bhishma. Bhishma, who hears this monologue of Duryodhana, he decides that it is time to tell Duryodhana that he doesn't need to be protected. That's why the verse goes, tasya sanjanayan harsham, to increase the cheerfulness. That's the meaning of that phrase. Simhanadam vinadya uchaihi. He makes a roaring sound like that of a lion. Seeing that Duryodhana is not confident about him, Bhishma, in order to increase the cheerfulness of Duryodhana, he roars like a lion. He gives out a huge roar by which the entire battlefield is reverberating with. And then he goes on to say, Shankham dadmahu pratapavan. The valiant one blew his conch. And why does he do this? Tasya sanjanayan harsham. To increase the cheerfulness of Duryodhana. And the moment Bhishma blows his conch, which is almost like the beginning of the war. It is a sign of preparedness where the commander-in-chief of the army blows the conch and saying that we are ready for the battle. And the moment Bhishma blows his conch, shankascha bheryascha, conches and bugles, panava anaka, trumpets and kettle drums, gomukhaha, cow horns, and all of these different, I think each one has their own instruments to proclaim that they are prepared and they are great warriors, as we said. And each one of them start blowing their conches and bugles, and the trumpets are blown, the kettle drums are beaten, and the cow horns are blown. And at this point, he says, Shabdaha tumula abhavat, which means the sound was tumultuous and the earth itself was shaking. So that's the meaning of the verses 12 and 13. We'll go to the next one because there's nothing more to say about in this particular verse.
తతశ్వేతైర్ హయైర్యుక్తే మహతి స్యందనే స్థితౌ మాధవః పాండవశ్చైవ దివ్యౌ శంఖౌ ప్రదధ్మతుః.
Then also Madhava and son of Pandu, seated in the magnificent chariot, yoked with white horses, blue divine conscious. So here for the first time, the two main characters of the Bhagavad Gita are spoken about in this verse. Because they were mentioned before by Duryodhana, Arjuna. He says that great warrior Arjuna is on the other side. But this is the first time this particular scene of Krishna as the charioteer, Arjuna as the warrior driving the traveling in the chariot, yoked with white horses. And this particular, it is the classroom where the Bhagavad Gita is going to be spoken by the Lord to his disciple, right? And it's a symbol in itself. Whenever we see that chariot with white horses and Krishna and a despondent looking Arjuna, that is more or less the way by which we look at the Gita-upadesha scene itself. So this is the verse where that scene is explained. He says that with white horses yoked to it. And the chariot itself is described as Mahati Syandana, which means a great chariot, because this is not an ordinary chariot. And this itself is, I think, a fact of envy for everybody who is there, because among all these hundreds of thousands of chariots which are assembled there, this chariot on which this great warrior Arjuna is seated is a very, very special one. And it is said that there are four horses yoked to this chariot. And of course, elsewhere in the Mahabharata and other Puranas, there are names for each one of these horses because they're very special. The chariot itself is very special because the chariot is not an ordinary one like the others. It is a gift from the God. And I'll not go into that entire story. There is this episode of the Khandavavana where once Krishna takes Arjuna there, and there is it's a long story where the Lord of Fire, Agni, is actually losing his luster, and he has to consume the Khandava Vana to regain his energy, and he's not able to do that because the Khandava Vana belongs to Takshaka, and Takshaka is under the protection of Lord Indra, who is the Lord of the Rains. So every time Agni tries to devour this Khandava Vana, he's been put off, so he's not able to do that, and because of that he's losing his luster. Krishna takes Arjuna to this particular place, and Agni requests the help of Krishna and Arjuna. And at that time, Krishna tells Agni that if you want us to do this, you will have to bestow Arjuna with appropriate weapons and instruments. So at that point, Agni gives him this chariot of the four white horses, which he uses later in the battle. He also gives him the Gandiva bow, which is very, very famous and synonymous with Arjuna. We're going to come to that. It'll be mentioned a few times in the first chapter itself. And then gives him two quivers of infinite capacity to dispense arrows. So in many ways, this is probably, you know, the dream ensemble for any warrior, is being gifted to Arjuna by the Lord of Fire, Agni himself. And this is how he gets the chariot. I think it's a very, very important point. The reason why I'm telling this story is, in many, many places, not only in the during the war, but even during Mahabharata, and if we listen to Swami's discourses, Swami would narrate some of these stories where the grace of Lord Krishna comes in places where they could not have done without that at all. Right, and this is a classic example of that, where Krishna knows that Arjuna will need some of these weapons and the chariot, which is so very powerful and very, very essential for him to win the battle. So it is he arranges this meeting in a sense with Agni and Arjuna, and he instructs Agni to give him this particular collection of things which will be useful for Arjuna. And this is what divine grace does. And Swami would, as I said, mentioned many, many stories in the Mahabharata where Arjuna comes to the rescue of the Pandavas, right? And that is why when the choice between the Narayani Sena and Krishna is offered, Arjuna has no hesitation in choosing Krishna. One, of course, is the love and devotion they have for Krishna. But I think Krishna has also given ample evidence of how God's grace or divine grace can help you in ways inexplicable, and one fills your life with sweetness and joy. It also makes you literally invincible in sorts, and I think that is one of the reasons why Duryodhana and the Kauravas were very, very scared, because they knew that there was this Krishna who was there on the other side. In fact, going back to that episode where Arjuna chooses Krishna over the Narayani Sena, Duryodhana is not able to contain his joy because he feels that Arjuna has made such a stupid choice of choosing an unarmed Krishna over this mighty army. So he comes back from that meeting very, very happy. But the moment Shakuni hears that he has made this choice, Shakuni says, "You've almost lost the battle, because you have no idea how much mischief this one Krishna can do being on the other side." And that is what divine grace can do, and that is how divine grace plays in our lives, right? And this aspect would be spoken of many, many times. In fact, the entire Bhagavad Gita itself is an expression of that divine grace, right? Any number of people go through such dilemmas in life when you're supposed to carry out some particular task. You're not sure whether you're supposed to do this, you're not supposed to do this. Is it right for you to abandon that act? Is it right for you to go ahead and do it as your duty? Many of us face such dilemmas in life. But here, Arjuna has this special blessing of receiving that advice from the Lord himself. And if we turn to Lord Krishna, we feel turn to the Lord saying that, "You enlighten my understanding, you enlighten my intellect," that advice is available even for us. And I think that is the endeavor in us going through the Bhagavad Gita itself. And that is the special added benefit that divine grace brings. And I think that is why this story I thought I should mention, where out of the blue, Krishna arranges this meeting, the Khandava Vana is created. In fact, the Khandava Vana is the place where later, after clearing out that forest, the Indraprastha, or the capital city of the Pandavas, were built. And it was that which caused jealousy in Duryodhana, and that was the one which was lost in the game of dice. And in many ways, the whole battle is being fought for that Indraprastha, which rightfully belongs to the Pandavas, right? So that is one of the things comes out I wanted to make a mention through this particular verse. So that is the 14th verse. So let's go to the 15th verse in the first chapter.
Panchajanyam Rishi Kesho Devadattan Dhananjayah Paundram Dadmau Mahashankham Bhima Karma Vrukodaraha.
Rishikesha blew the Panchajanya, and Dhananjaya blew the Devadatta, and Bhima, the doer of terrible deeds, blew the great conch Paundra. So this is the verse where this one, and of course the next verse also, the names of the various conches are given. And it's important to probably speak about the conches of Krishna and Arjuna at least, because as it's mentioned in the shloka itself, it refers to their conches alone as Divyau Shankhau, which means theirs were not ordinary conches, they were divine conches. The story of the Panchajanya, of course, is a legend in itself. I'm sure most of you would be aware of it. When Krishna is under the tutelage of sage Sandipani, where he goes for his formal education, after completing the education, it is tradition that you offer Guru Dakshina, or a form of an expression of your gratitude in the form of an offering to the Guru, right, is made. And at that point, Krishna and Balarama go to sage Sandipani and ask him, "What can we offer to you?" And even before asking that, they ask him that, "We've been under you, we've been living here for so many years. We always found that there was a deep sense of pain and agony which was there always constantly in you and in the Guru Matha. We want to know what is the cause of that. And that's when Sandipani says about his son who was lost, who was drowned in the ocean, I think. And Sandipani says that I keep thinking of him, and whenever I see you, all the more I get reminded of my son. So Krishna promises his guru, Sage Sandipani, he says, I will retrieve your son and come. And that's how Krishna and Balarama go to the ocean, and the deity or the lord of the ocean appears in front of them and says that it is not my mistake. There is a demon. It's actually a demon which is supposed to be in the shape of a whale. That is how the story goes. His name is Panchajana, right? Panchajana is the name, is that demon who swallows the son of Sandipani. So Krishna goes there, he fights this battle with this demon and retrieves the son, and also finds this particular conch which is in the possession of this demon. And that is why the name Panchajanya. So that is the conch which Krishna uses thereafter. And of course it is said that Arjuna's conch name is Devadatta, which is again a gift from, I think, Varuna. Varuna gives that special conch to Arjuna. The reason why all of these are mentioned, you know, the chariot was mentioned with white horses, and as we go forward, there's going to be a mention about the flag on Arjuna's chariot. There's going to be a mention about the Gandiva, the bow which Arjuna uses. I think the reason why some of these things are mentioned is, it is important, especially in this chapter, because it shows that Arjuna has been preparing for this moment for a very, very long time, right? It is, and it is with much interest, because he is a warrior at the end of the day, and an opportunity to show his talent and his might is something which every warrior passionately waits for. So is the case with Arjuna. He's been waiting for this opportunity, and he's been preparing for a very, very long time by gathering all of these things. And I think that is why it is specifically mentioned that all of these things, you know, this is the name of the conch, this is the name of the chariot and the bow and all of these things, right? And in this verse, of course, there is also a mention of Bhima. The last line of that speaks about Bhima. His name, the conch that he blows is called Paundram, right? But Bhima is referred to through two adjectives here. He's not referred to merely as Bhima, but he's called Bhima Karma. The word Bhima itself means the terrible one. So Bhima Karma means the one who always takes up terrible tasks. And when I say terrible, it's not like bad in that sense, but the most difficult task which is there available, that is what Bhima will always take up, right? That is what they always speak of Bhima as. And that's why when he goes for the training in weaponry to Dronacharya, he's drawn towards the mace, because that seems to be the toughest to lift and wield because of its weight. So always Bhima is known to take up the most difficult task available in that particular time and space. And that's why he is given this name Bhima Karma. And there's a very interesting other adjective that is used, is Vrikodhara. Vrikodhara, Vrika means a fox and Udara means a stomach. And there are two ways of explaining this. And one is, he has an appetite of a fox. A fox cannot ever be satisfied. That's what they say, that it can eat endlessly, and most other animals, when they are satisfied, they stop eating. But the fox is not like that. As long as food is available, it keeps eating and it has an endless appetite. So Bhima is described as one with enormous appetite. But also, a fox's stomach is always flat. In spite of all its eating, the fox has a flat belly. So they say that this is also a description of Bhima's physique, where he's not only a huge and well-built warrior, but he's not a flabby warrior in that sense. He's not overly built or oversized or overweight in that sense. He's a very muscular person, and he has a flat stomach. That's what is meant by this ability, that this adjective called Vrikodhara, which means Vrikodhara, which means he has the belly of a fox, an endless appetite, and also a flat stomach like that of a fox. So that is the meaning of this verse, which is the 15th one. Let's listen to the 16th verse.
Ananta Vijayam Raja Kunti Putro Yudhishthirah నకులః సహ దేవశ్చ సుఘోషమణి పుష్పకౌ.
King Yudhishthira, the son of Kunti, blew his conch shell, the Ananta Vijaya, and Nakula and Sahadeva blew Sughosha and Manipushpaka. So that's the meaning of the 16th verse. As I said, even in this, the names of the, in this verse and the previous one, the names of the conches of Krishna, Arjuna and the other Pandavas are mentioned. The interesting thing about this particular verse is, Sanjaya is, as we all know, Sanjaya is relating whatever is happening in the battlefield to Dhritarashtra. And what does he say? He says, Ananta Vijayam Raja Kunti Putro Yudhishthira. He refers to Yudhishthira as Raja, right? And clearly a sign that he does not lose this opportunity to remind Dhritarashtra that he is supposed to be the king. First of all, you are sitting on the throne and you're not letting him become the king. And now you are saying that after me, my son Duryodhana is the legal heir to the throne, right? So he does not lose this opportunity to remind Dhritarashtra that he is wrongly sitting on a throne which does not belong to him. And as I said, this is the nature of Sanjaya. He's very, very loyal to Dhritarashtra. Even though many others leave him, Sanjaya does not leave Dhritarashtra till the end, till the last moment. He's very loyal, but still he's a very honest and very straightforward person. He does not hesitate or fear speaking the truth even to the king. And that is one of the things which he did. In fact, even in the Bhishma Parva, the chapter where Bhagavad Gita appears, there is this huge section where Sanjaya describes the entire landscape of Bharatavarsha or the Indian subcontinent to Dhritarashtra. Dhritarashtra asks him about far off lands and the people there, and he gives all of these description. And at the end of it, Sanjaya again makes an attempt to tell Dhritarashtra to stop the war. And very abruptly he says, so, O king, why don't you speak to Duryodhana, your son, and ask him to go for peace instead of going for this great war, right? So Sanjaya is that sort of a person, very, very loyal, very faithful to his master, but does not hesitate to tell what is the right advice. So in this verse, as we said, the names of the conches are mentioned. Yudhishthira's conch is Ananta Vijaya, which means endless victory. Nakula's is called Sughosha, which means that which has a good sound. And Sahadeva's was called Manipushpaka, which means the conch which is adorned with beautiful beads and gems. So that is the 16th verse. Next we'll listen to the 17th and the 18th verse. I think that'll make more sense because it's listening to the two verses together. So we'll listen to the 17th and 18th verse and then we'll discuss about it.
కాశ్యశ్చ పరమేశ్వాసః శిఖండీ చ మహారథః ధృష్టద్యుమ్నో విరాటశ్చ సాత్యకిశ్చ పరాజితః ద్రుపదో ద్రౌపదేయాశ్చ సర్వశః పృథివీపతే సౌభద్రశ్చ మహాబాహుః శంఖాన్ దద్ముః పృథక్ పృథక్.
The great archer, the king of Kashi, the great fighter Shikhandi, Drishtadyumna, Virata and the unconquerable Satyaki, Drupada, the sons of Draupadi, and the others, O king, such as the son of Shubhadra, greatly armed, all blew their respective conches. So there's nothing much to explain in this. I think most of the characters we've already spoken about. So this is just a description of Sanjaya telling that after Bhishma first blew his conch, Krishna and Arjuna blew their conch, Yudhishthira and the other Pandavas blew their conch, and now there are conches being blown by all the other warriors, and all of these warriors are those who are fighting on behalf of the Pandavas. So he is specifically mentioning that the Pandava warriors, the warriors on the Pandava side now blow their conch. And the next verse, he explains what is the effect of that when they blow their conch. We'll listen to that. That is the verse 19.
सघोषोधार्तराष्ट्राणाम् हृदयानि व्यधारयत् नभश्च पृथिवीं चैव तुमुलोभ्यनुनादयन्.
The blowing of these different conch shells became uproarious and thus vibrating both in the sky and on the earth. It shattered the hearts of the sons of Dhritarashtra. So when Sanjaya speaks about Bhishma blowing the conch and roaring like a lion, he does not speak of what is the effect of that on the Pandava side. And as we mentioned in the beginning itself, Sanjaya can not only see the events that are happening and listen to what is being spoken, but he can also sense the feelings of those who are speaking it. What is the nature? What is going on in their mind? I think this is an important thing to keep in mind as we progress in the first chapter itself, especially when Arjuna begins to speak. So he is able to see that when the Kauravas start blowing their conches and beating the kettle drums, there is not much effect on the Pandavas. But when the Pandavas start blowing their conch, he says, Saghosho Dhartharashtranam Hridayani Vyadarayat, which means with that sound, the sons of Dhritarashtra were shaken. He said the sound was so loud. Maybe one way of looking at it is, it is also a sign of the numbers that have come. Duryodhana did not expect so many people to appear for them, maybe. And the other thing is the fear that I was speaking about. When you're on the path of unrighteousness, when you are on the path of untruth, there is a fear that you can never get away with. There will always be the conscience pricking, which will always be telling you about an evil future that is the premonition of an evil future that is coming up to you, right? And so when this sound of the conches being blown from the Pandava side comes, the sons of Dhritarashtra are shaken by it, right? And then he says that the sound not only shakes the heart of the sons of Dhritarashtra, the Kauravas, he says, Nabhascha prithivim chaiva, which means even the earth and the sky shivered and reverberated with that sound. So that is the ninth verse in the Bhagavad Gita. I think after this comes the real important part of the first chapter. So first chapter, 19 verses, is more like setting the stage, what is happening in the battlefield, what are the different scenes, who spoke what to whom, who all have assembled, and the entire description has been given to Dhritarashtra by Sanjaya. It is from the next verse where the real scene, we call the first chapter as Arjuna Vishada Yoga or Arjuna's grief, right? And that is the essence of the first chapter. I think that begins from the next verse. The next one I'm going to play for you is actually verse 20, 21 and 22, because though they are three different verses, they are more like one sentence broken up into three verses. So we listen to that. This is the verse 20 followed by 21 and 22. And then I'll read out the meaning and we'll discuss about it.
Atha vyavasthitan drishtva dhartarashtran kapidhvajah pravritte shastra sampate धनुरुद्यम्य पांडवः हृषीकेशं तदा वाक्यं इदमाह महीपते अर्जुन उवाच सेनयोरुभयोर् मध्ये रथं स्थापयमेच्युत यावदेतान् निरीक्षेहम् योद्धुकामानवस्थितान् कैर्मया सह योद्धव्यम् अस्मिन् रणसमुद्यमे.
Then, seeing the people of Dhritarashtra's side standing arrayed and the discharge of weapons about to begin, Arjuna, the son of Pandu, whose ensign or flag is Hanuman, took up his bow and said the following to Krishna, O Lord of the earth. Arjuna said, In the middle between the two armies, place my chariot, O Krishna, so that I may behold those who stand here desirous to fight, and know with whom I must fight when the battle is about to commence. That's the meaning of verses 20, 21 and 22. The interesting thing about the verse 20 is the reference to a name which is given to Arjuna. He's called Kapidvaja. Sanjaya refers to him as Kapidvaja because Arjuna's chariot has a flag on top on which is Hanuman, right? The one on whose flag that flies on the mast of the chariot is Hanuman. And again, this also has a very interesting story, which is a Chinnakatha which Swami would narrate. Probably I'll narrate that. Again, a sign of God's grace and divine grace when it comes into our life, and how it helps us in ways and times when nothing else, our own efforts and our own energies fail us, right? Swami would narrate this story of how when Arjuna was on a pilgrimage towards the southern part of India, he reaches Rameshwaram. Rameshwaram is the place where Lord Rama, before he embarks on this journey to Lanka across the ocean, he performs worship to a linga and propitiates Lord Shiva before he takes up this task. And that's why he installs this linga, which is referred to as Rameshwara. And Rameshwaram, of course, is a very renowned pilgrimage site even today. So Arjuna goes to Rameshwaram and he's at the threshold of the ocean where the bridge was built. And probably in the Dwapara Yuga, the bridge could still be seen maybe. And he stands there, and today we refer to that town as Dhanushkoti. It is believed that you still can see from the satellites a sign of a man-made bridge from the tip of Dhanushkoti town towards the current Sri Lanka. So Arjuna stands there, and Arjuna is a great warrior, and we know that he's capable of doing all kinds of magic things with his bow and arrow. So he looks at it and he says that, you know, Lord Rama was a great archer just like me, you know, probably that's how he puts it. He says Rama was a great archer. Why did he have to take the help of monkeys to build a bridge? He could have built a bridge merely by using his bow and arrows. Right, that's what he's thinking, and he actually remarks this aloud, and Lord Hanuman appears there, and he asks Arjuna that, you know, how are you so sure that a bridge which is built with arrows can be strong enough to hold the monkey army? Millions and millions of monkeys are supposed to march past this bridge and reach Sri Lanka. How do you think that it would have been strong enough to hold the weight of so many monkeys? So then Arjuna says that I'm confident that it can be done, you know, and if I could do it, I'm sure Lord Rama, being a great archer himself, could have done it himself too. So Hanuman says that a bridge that you can build in that way with arrows will not stand the weight of even one monkey. And Arjuna immediately takes that up as a challenge. And what does he do? He begins to build a bridge with his arrows, tightly knit together many, many arrows. And he says that, since you've thrown this challenge to me, bring down this bridge if you can. And if you bring it down, I will give up my life. I'm ready to jump into the fire and end my life if I lose this challenge. So the bridge is built, and Hanuman makes one small leap on the bridge and the entire bridge collapses. And at that moment, Arjuna is really, his honor is hurt. He says that I've lost in the battle, and he's about to build a fire into which he wants to jump. And Lord Krishna appears there at that moment, and he looks at Arjuna and says, what are you trying to do? Why are you trying to kill yourself? And Arjuna says that, you know, this was a challenge. I said that if I lose this challenge, I'm ready to end my life. So Krishna tells him that, see, any challenge or any such duel should have a referee. Somebody should be there as a middleman who declares who is the winner. So you don't have a referee here. How can you say that you have lost the battle? So then Krishna says that let's have the battle again. Let's have this challenge replayed. And this time Arjuna builds an even stronger bridge. Of course, he tries to make it more, durable. And Hanuman jumps on this bridge and he jumps up and down and he tries and he takes the form which he takes when he, takes on the demons on the way when he is going towards Lanka. A huge form, a multi-storied building form of Hanuman. He takes up that and he tries to jump on the bridge and it still doesn't break. And it is then that it strikes Hanuman that the bridge that they built, the Vanaras built, was built purely based on the name of Rama. Just by taking the name of Rama, the stones were able to float on the water, and that is how the entire bridge was built. It was not purely an engineering marvel of the Vanaras, Nala and Nila. It was purely the grace of Rama that enabled them to build a bridge which could not only help them cross it, which also stood the test of time, right? And at that moment, he realizes that it was Rama's grace which made that bridge stand. And it is the same Rama who has come as Krishna, and it is his grace that is making this bridge stand too. So it is not that the Vanaras were great, or it is not that Arjuna was great. It was Rama who was great, and it is the same Rama who has come as Krishna, and it is his word which is great again. So the moment Hanuman realizes this, he falls at Krishna's feet and he says, I'm sorry. So Krishna reprimands Hanuman, saying that, you for a moment forgot that it was all my grace that you were able to do and accomplish whatever you could. And then he turns to Arjuna and he reprimands Arjuna too. He says that humility is the true ornament for a great warrior, and you should never forget that. You should never get carried away by your strengths. And he explains that in no way this bridge could have stood without my word. So never forget this. So at that moment, Hanuman realizes that here is this great warrior who has won the favor of his Rama. So he offers his help. Hanuman says that, when you're participating in any great war, I will come and I will be on the flag of the chariot that you're driving, and I will, in whatever way possible, help you in that battle. And that is the word that Hanuman gives, and that is his expression of gratitude to Rama, who has come down as Krishna. And that is why in that Kurukshetra war, when Arjuna comes to the battlefield with his grand chariot with white horses, on the flag of that chariot is an insignia of Lord Hanuman. And Hanuman actually is present in the form of that flag. That is why the name which is given to Arjuna is Kapidwaja, the one on whose flag is Hanuman, right? So anyway, I think this is clear, is that the part where Arjuna, this is clearly where the reflections of Arjuna will begin, right? So he tells Krishna, Senayor Ubhayor Madhye Ratham Sthapaya Ratham Stapaya Me Achyuta. So he says, oh Krishna, take my chariot and place it right in the middle of these two armies. Why does he say this? Why does he want to do that? He says, I want to see who has come to fight and all that. But he will explain that in the next verse, the 23rd verse. We'll listen to the 23rd verse and I'll give you the meaning for that too.
योत्स्यमानानवेक्षेहम् य एतेऽत्र समागताः धार्तराष्ट्रस्य दुर्बुद्धेः युद्धे प्रियचिकीर्षवः.
Let me see those who have come here to fight, wishing to please the evil-minded son of Dhritarashtra. That's the meaning of the 23rd verse. So here, Arjuna is also doing what Duryodhana was doing some time back, right? Duryodhana came, he surveyed the people who had assembled to fight against him. He surveyed those who had come to fight for him. In his own words, who had come to die for him. The same thing now Arjuna wishes to do. He tells Krishna, you take me to the middle of the battlefield. He says, I want to see the people who have assembled on both sides. And in this particular verse, he says, I particularly want to see who are these great kings, because in those days there was a lot of reverence given to kings. A king was called Naresha, the lord of men, right? Really worship-worthy kings. And such kings have assembled to fight on behalf of Duryodhana, even though they know that the dharma is clearly on the side of the Pandavas. So he says, I want to see who are these great kings, who are these great warriors who have come wishing to please the evil-minded son of Dhritarashtra. He says, Durbuddhe. Duryodhana is having a contorted idea of what is right and wrong. His buddhi is clouded. His buddhi is going astray. To aid such a Duryodhana, there are people who have assembled in this battlefield, and I'm surprised that they've come here. I want to see who are those people who have come here. So that's the meaning of the 23rd verse. I think probably we'll have time for one or two more verses. We'll go to the 24th verse. We'll listen to it and I'll tell you the meaning after that.
संजय उवाच एवमुक्तो हृषीकेशो गुडाकेशेन भारत सेनयोरुभयोर्मध्ये स्थापयित्वा रथोत्तमम्.
संजय सेड, ओ डिसेंडेंट ऑफ भारत, बीइंग दस एड्रेस्ड बाय अर्जुन, Lord Krishna drew up the fine chariot in the midst of the armies of both parties. So Arjuna says, take me to the middle. And here Sanjaya says that that's exactly what Krishna did. He takes it to the middle and he places there. You can quite understand the inquisitiveness which must have filled the mind of Dhritarashtra. He must be wondering what is happening here. What is Arjuna doing? What is he trying to do? One part of it says that for a moment he actually thinks that did Arjuna go for a peace truce? Did Arjuna offer? Actually, that was one thing which was in the mind of Dhritarashtra till the end. He never thought that the Pandavas will come for battle. He always thought that their goodness was their weakness and their goodness will stop them from doing anything like this. So he was hoping even till the last minute that Yudhishthira would come and say that I don't want to fight. You can have the kingdom. I will go back to the forest with my brothers. That is what he was expecting, and probably he would have thought for a moment that Arjuna is going to do that. But of course, as I said in the beginning, this is a flashback in itself. This is after the 10 days of battle. So he knows that the battle has begun. He knows that the Pandavas have made inroads in the form of felling Bhishma. But probably he would have been wondering, what is this? What is Arjuna trying to do? Why is he going to the middle of the battlefield? And is he trying to reach out to anybody there? And is he trying to make a last proposal of peace? What is he trying to do? The interesting thing about this particular verse is Arjuna and Krishna are referred to as Rishikesha and Gudakesha. Hrishikesha and Gudakesha. Hrishikesha is of course a name which has occurred a couple of times before already in the first chapter. But the first time Arjuna is being referred to as Gudakesha. As somebody very beautifully said, among the many things, the Bhagavad Gita is also a very good repository for good boy names. If you're looking to name your child, the newborn child, because there are so many names of Lord Krishna and Arjuna that are mentioned, and as we can see, there are so many names which have already been mentioned, Dhananjaya, Partha, Pandu, and Pandava, and here it is Gudakesha. It's an interesting name. Hrishikesha itself is a very interesting name, and I thought we'll just spend a few minutes talking about that. The word Gudakesha is split as Gudaka plus Isha. Gudaka means sloth. It means it could even be described as sleep, because one of the descriptions of Arjuna is Arjuna has conquered sleep. He can wage a war for many, many days, or he can keep awake for many, many days without falling asleep or without letting lethargy and dullness overcome his mind. That was how much control he had over his body among the many things that he could, among the many talents that he had. That's why he is referred to as Gudakesha. Gudaka means sloth or sleep or any kind of dullness of the mind. So he is Gudakesha and Krishna is referred to as Hrishikesha. Now, Hrishika means the senses. The word Hrishi itself means pleasure. And Hrishika means that which is a source of pleasure. And in the body, it is said that the senses are the source of pleasure. And Hrishikesha is Hrishikesha. The reason why this is a very important appellation of the Lord Hrishikesha is, in many ways, that is what Krishna is doing for Arjuna. There is this very beautiful analogy of the body being a chariot, which is given in Kathopanishad. I myself would have quoted it many, many times on the other shows, Answering Booth and Shravanam, Mananam, Nididhyasanam, where this very one beautiful and very graphic analogy of the body being a chariot, the senses being the horses, the buddhi being the charioteer, and the jivatma or the individual being the one who's traveling in the chariot, and the reins themselves being the manas aspect of the mind, the working mind as we would call that. So this is one thing which would often be given, and it comes from, as I said, the Kathopanishad. Here the horses are meant to be the senses. So the charioteer is one who is the master of the horses. He not only guides the horses when he is driving the chariot, but the charioteer also has the role of taking care of the horses, right? And that is one of the descriptions that is given in the Mahabharata, where Krishna not only drives Arjuna's chariot, but he does all the duties of a charioteer. He takes care of the horses. The horses do get injured during the battle, and the charioteer has to apply medicine for the horses. He has to take them, he has to give them the food and the water. So Krishna does all of this. The symbolism of that is, the Lord is the one who has to be rightfully be made the master of the senses. And Swami would often say this. There is a very beautiful verse in Telugu which Swami would chant. I'm not able to recollect that verbatim, where Swami says, what should be done with each one of the senses? Swami would say, the eyes should be used to look at the beautiful form of the Lord. The ears should be used to listen to the glories of the Lord. The tongue should be used to speak and sing the glories of the Lord. Right? So it would be, Swami would say that each one of these senses have to be used to glorify the Lord. Why? Because the Lord is Hrishikesha. He is the master of the senses, and you have to make him the master. You should make him the one who guides the senses. He should be given the role of the charioteer who sits there and guides the senses. And that is why this particular appellation for Lord Krishna, Hrishikesha, is very, very beautiful. And in this particular verse, it is juxtaposed with the name given to Arjuna, Gudakesha and Hrishikesha. And this is probably the pair which we all should endeavor to reach, where as an individual, we have to overcome dullness of the mind. We should become ourselves Gudakesha, who do not let tamas or slothfulness overcome us. And we make the Lord the charioteer, the Lord the person who sits and marshals the senses. That is the role that has to be given to the Lord. That is what we need to do. And that is why these few verses that we've gone through is very, very significant, because it is not only the scene in the battlefield, but it is the description of every individual who is the master of the chariot and who is the one who travels in the chariot, who is the Gudakesha and who is the Hrishikesha. I think we might not have time for one more verse. I'll probably speak a little more about this particular concept before I end this particular, as we are speaking about the chariot and the Lord being the charioteer. As I had mentioned, in the Kathopanishad, the charioteer is supposed to be the buddhi, right? The buddhi is the one who is supposed to be the charioteer. What is the significance of Lord Krishna taking up the role of the charioteer here? It is said that, what is the role of the buddhi? The buddhi is supposed to discriminate, tell you what is right and what is wrong. So where does the buddhi draw this inspiration from? The buddhi, first of all, draws the inspiration from its conscience, which is the inner voice, which is always there. And it also draws from the knowledge which it gathers through the process of life. The kind of advice that it receives, the kind of probably the books that a person reads, all of these contribute to the discrimination of the buddhi, the ability to choose between right and wrong and what needs to be and what should not be done. But when we come to the Lord, when we come to a guru is not useful to our life unless and until we merge the guru's words with our own buddhi, right? The guru's words must itself become the buddhi. The buddhi should not merely make references to the guru's words or use the guru's words as and when it is suitable to it, but it should make the guru's words itself the buddhi. And this is explained in the Upanishads and the Vedas as the guru's words should become an internal pramana, a way by which we lead our lives. So that is one of the significances of Lord Krishna becoming the charioteer. When Lord Krishna becomes the charioteer, he takes up this role where he not only gives advice to the buddhi of Arjuna, but he becomes the buddhi itself. And that is how we need to approach the guru. When we say that you have to surrender to the guru, when we say that we have to, the word which we use is pranipata, where we offer ourselves to the guru, what we actually offer is this buddhi. We go to the master and say that I offer my discrimination to you, that whatever you say, I will take it as the basis for my discrimination. I will take it as the shabda pramana, as that based on which I will make all my decisions, right? That is the significance of this imagery of Lord Krishna becoming the charioteer and the analogy which is given in the Kathopanishad, where it says that the body is the chariot, the senses are the horse, the individual is the one who travels in the chariot, the reins are the mind, and the buddhi is the charioteer. Here, the Lord himself becomes the charioteer. The Rishikesha, the Lord of the senses, you should make him the Lord of your senses. And that is when you are ready to receive the Gita from the Lord and you are ready to be guided in every stage of your life by God. So I think we'll conclude with that. We have completed 24 verses of the first chapter. The next week we will begin the real Vishada Yoga of Arjuna, the first chapter, where what I think we have to look out for is the difference in attitude between Arjuna and Duryodhana. Duryodhana also surveyed the army, what was running in his mind. Now Arjuna is also going to survey the army. We will see what is running in his mind. But for that, you'll have to join me again next week at 7:30 PM for the next episode of the Gita series, A Triune Pilgrimage. I thank you all for joining me this evening. I most humbly offer this effort at Swami's lotus feet. And in a few minutes from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu and his team for the Vahini Satsang, the last segment of today's Thursday Live. I'll meet you all next week. Till then, happy listening.
are listening to Radio Sai Thursday Live. Stay tuned.